the human condition. It allows us to question what we are told, and in so doing to develop our own views. Any upbringing where doubt is banished from our experience, whether it be political, religious or scientific, is one that I hope we would shun if we had the choice. And if doubt is part of life, and science is part of life, then doubt in science has to be a given. But let's go one step further. Doubt, I would argue, can be the great asset of the free thinker, who is willing to take on and challenge an existing dogma. One such was an Australian physician, Barry Marshall. As part of his training, Dr. Marshall was working in a lab with another scientist, Robin Warren, studying bacteria. Contrary to popular scientific wisdom, they found that certain bacteria, Helicobacter pylori, could survive in a highly acidic environment, such as the stomach. So they began to doubt the established view that ulcers were caused by excess acid, itself the result of stress. Marshall and Warren found themselves in the position of doubting something that scientists had thought they had known all along: stress led to ulcers. But what if ulcers were the result of bacterial infection instead? What would happen to the blockbuster drugs currently on the market for ulcers, but perhaps, after all, designed for the wrong biological target? Everyone was against us, Marshall recalls. It's not surprising that both the pharmaceutical industry and the medical establishment were against them. The implications, not least financial, were huge. But the scientific establishment? Sadly, closed minds that should have remained open to doubt, in fact, good old unscientific prejudice, delayed significantly the final acceptance of Marshall and Warren's theory. What tipped the balance in their favour and ensured that they won the Nobel Prize was not the emergence of misgivings or doubt. It was Marshall drinking a glass of medium containing the bacteria, duly giving himself an ulcer, and eventually being cured by antibiotics. Such significant doubt, challenging the mainstream, challenging accepted patterns of thought, is a paradigm shift, a phrase first coined by Thomas Kuhn in his 50-year-old classic, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. A paradigm is an accepted way of looking at things, or in Kuhn's own words, what members of a scientific community, and they alone, share. According to Kuhn, a paradigm is more than just a single, simple theory, but rather the entire worldview within which it exists. Such a view may encompass uncomfortable anomalies, facts and findings that just don't fit, and they're all brushed aside because of the intellectual discomfort they will bring in their wake. But as such anomalies, not least those from experimental data, start to accumulate, so some scientists, like Marshall and Warren, begin to doubt the whole picture. And then the struggle begins between the old order and the new. I have my own experiences of manning the barricades against a scientific ancien regime, where doubt has played a major role. Accepted wisdom, well entrenched, believed to be proven for a century, is that a certain chemical messenger, important in heart and muscles as well as the brain, is broken down as soon as it's had its powerful effect by a specific enzyme, also well established and thought to be irrefutable. So where is the anomaly that Kuhn would require to start a revolution? Not in the function of the enzyme, but in the somewhat bizarre possibility that it might have a second job as well, an alter ego that has nothing to do with being an enzyme. This heresy, as some have called it, was first posited in the late 60s, early 70s, by one Alec Karksmar, a biochemist, and then by Anne Silver, a histologist. In best Kuhnian tradition, there were just too many anomalies, too many places in the brain and throughout the body where the enzyme was present, but the chemical messenger, its accepted target for enzymatic destruction, was absent. Nature, it was thought, would not waste valuable resources in manufacturing such a large chemical for no apparent reason. So could it have a second function? The revolution had got underway, and I, as a rookie graduate student, rallied to the banner. But what started as the subject of my doctoral thesis evolved over the years to be my scientific life's work, investigating whether this familiar old enzyme actually has a novel role in the brain in its own right. In my lab, we are now working on a tantalising possibility. Perhaps a crucial fragment of this molecule breaks away to play a pivotal role in the as-yet unidentified mechanism underlying neurodegenerative disorders such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. But even after 30 or more years of publishing the step-by-step findings that pave, or rather zigzag, a way forward, the basic concept that our enzyme could function in ways other than as an enzyme still meets with opposition. Whilst it is obviously right and proper that new ideas should be doubted, and if I want to express doubt, then surely others must be free to do so as well, a serious problem nowadays in science is that the establishment is reluctant to give time of day to what Kuhn called paradigm shifts. Funding is an issue, of course. These are austere times, and when things are tight, the natural human tendency is to become even more risk-averse and to batten down the hatches. Funding bodies will offer what is familiar, uncontroversial and safe, and ensure that basic, long-held assumptions are not scrutinised too closely. In a number of conversations I've had with colleagues, I hear of a new concept creeping in. Bias-free research. Of course, who would ever want bias, scientific or otherwise? However, what is really meant by this pernicious phrase is that the work is not so much free of bias, but of any startlingly new hypothesis. This approach harks back to precisely what put me off science at school, applying a technique, albeit challenging and impressive, and to report what you have measured. The findings cannot be doubted, but without a hypothesis to vindicate them, I would argue that they have no real value. Doubt in science is integral, not so much to what scientists do, but to how we think. It can be harnessed for putting on the intellectual brakes, as well as for mandating acceleration into new areas. The direction and the speed we choose lie with each individual. Not so much life imitating art as life imitating science.
Baroness Susan Greenfield making her case for doubt in science in tonight's essay. Tomorrow evening, Madeleine Bunting focuses on doubt in religion and why she's found it such a useful ally. That's tomorrow's essay at the regular time of 10:45. This week's programmes are produced by David Coombs and they are a CTVC production for BBC Radio 3. Well, I'm afraid we're running a little bit late because of our earlier live concert. Apologies for that. Jonathan Swain will be here on time at 11:30 with music through the night. But now, at 11:07, we're able to join Verity Sharp for tonight's Late Junction. And we're starting here with a piece of music by the Chinese composer Da Jun Yao, a live recording of an electroacoustic piece built from samples of Mandarin Chinese. It's called The Satisfaction of Oscillation. I'm not going to do that.
Dum 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 d So that is The Satisfaction of Oscillation by Da Jun Yao, who founded a pioneering field recording project 15 years ago called the Chinese Sound Unit. And he now teaches sound art theory in Hangzhou province. More about him on his website, dajun.com. And with a similar fluidity, this is the music of the Hungarian composer and pianist George Kurtág and his piece Perpetuum Mobile.
¿Qué te importa que te ame? Si tú no me quieres ya, el amor que ya ha pasado no se puede recordar. Fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día le amo ya. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. Si la cosa que uno quiere se pudiera alcanzar, si me quisiera lo mismo que 20 años atrás, con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad. ¿Qué te importa que te ame si tú no me quieres ya? El amor que ya ha pasado no se debe recordar. Fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día le amo ya. Hoy represento un pasado, no me puedo conformar. Si la cosa que uno quiere se pudiera alcanzar, si me quisiera lo mismo que 20 años atrás, con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Que se arranca sin piedad. Hey, un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad.
Well, I love that album when it first came out, and it still gets to me now. Cuban pianist Bebo Valdés, who's now in his 90s, would you believe, playing alongside the relatively young flamenco singer Diego El Sigala, and that's on the album Lágrimas Negras. And that song all about a love that's long since died. I was the dream of your life a distant day ago. Today I belong to the past. You're listening to Late Junction with me, Verity Sharp. And here from Helsinki are the very creative duo Lepisto and Alehti. This is jazz chords and bass lines colliding with Scandinavian folk tunes on their new album called Radio Moskva. This tune is Lokoku.
Thank you.
Lokaku from the album Radio Moskva, named after the radio station that the bass player Pekka Lehti used to tune into as a child from his home in Sweden, hoping to find musical inspiration from across the border. Now, exciting news this week is that we have another of our ear-bending and generally rule-breaking Late Junction sessions for you. The composer and instrument inventor, Max Dwardner, is going to be here on Thursday night, bringing a couple of friends, and they're going to fashion music out of cello overtones, whirling pipes and electronics. So just in anticipation of that tonight, I thought I'd play you a track of Max Dwardner's called Automatic. After this by Robert Jarvis. Now, he's a musician with a keen interest in people and place. And a recent project took him to the village of Lambourne in Berkshire to capture in sound some of the pride that the villagers have there of their long historical association with horse racing. This piece features the voice of Jack Dowdswell.
When I came to Lambourne, first of all, when I was 14, my day's work was to get up in the morning and ride yearlings. And then I rode horses that had to be kept quiet. Full of riding. And then I had my afternoon work to do. And I can remember that my afternoon work I had to do, the jobs I had to do every day. Hay, oats, carrots, wood, chaff. Hay, oats, carrots, wood, chaff, copper, loser's match. I did it for 5 years. I can remember the jobs I had to do every day. Hay I had to carry from the barn. Oats I had to big bags, I crushed them for horse at night. Carrots I had to wash and cut up the horse. The wood to keep the copper going. Chaff, horse's feed. And the mash I had to mix. Thank you.
largo. Y a la lateral. Chiquen y a la cuateral. Chiquen y a la cuasarga. Y a la lateral. Chiquen y a la cuateral. Yalla ko sarga, yalla lateral. Oh, 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 sama jigen degluma fonkal ma jigen yalla la teral jigen mo jur jambar jigen mo jur wali wo yalla la teral jigen mo jur musicien jigen mo jur wali wo yalla la teral.
That's a new voice from Senegal, Amadou Diagne, recorded by World Network for their introducing series. So look out for performances from him over the summer. He's based now in the UK and often runs drumming workshops. I know he's going to be at Wadebridge Folk Festival doing just that in August. And I bet he'll be in a lot more places besides. Do look out for him, Amadou Diagne. And another talented African musician, now based in the UK, is the kora player Sura Suzo, who was born in the Gambia, and he now creates music firmly rooted in that tradition. This is Jimbaseng. Thank you. Kora player Sura Suzo with Jimba Seng from his album Sila Kang. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3 with me, Verity Sharp, and here is Rolf Hind with the sonatas 5 and 6 for a prepared piano by John Cage.
Out its silver horn,
That's Mary Hampton, her version of Honey in the Rock, which is on her album Folly. And if you're in Bristol on June the 10th, she's going to be taking part in a day of traditional weirdness at the Folk House. They're calling the event Weird Lore. And as well as Mary Hampton, you'll be able to hear Telling the Bees, Emily Portman, Sharon Krauss and many more. So that's June the 10th at the Folk House in Bristol. Here is Mancunian trumpeter Neil Yates with his Five Countries trio and an atmospheric piece called Rainy Harbour.
Thank you.
Well, that's the wonderfully textural playing of Neil Yates. And we were just speculating here in the studio whether he wasn't playing the flugelhorn rather than the trumpet. And joined there by the guitarist Zulz Bender with Cormac Byrne on the percussion. And that's Rainy Harbour from their latest album, Five Countries. You'll find details of that and, of course, everything else that you've heard tonight on the Late Junction page of the Radio 3 website. And, of course, you can listen to the programme again there too for the next 7 days. Now, in Crete, a pentazali is a showy five-step circle dance. It's mainly danced by men, and it's a kind of show of athletic prowess. Each dancer puts a hand on another's shoulder until a line is formed, and then that line slowly progresses around anti-clockwise, and the music gets more and more mesmerising and frenetic while the men take it in turns to jump higher and higher. This pentazali is preceded by a contilies, which amounts to a bit of musical jousting.
Σε πρωτόειδα. Ο παπύργο με διάμαντο πετρές, πύργο με διάμαντο πετρές, να σε βάλω. Άντε, στα χτίσω να σε βάλω και θα τσατσίσω τα κλειδιά και θα τσατσίσω τα κλειδιά να μη σε ξαναβγάλω. Στεναγμούς μου. Όπα, όπα, ψάμα στεναγμούς μου, αψάμα στεναγμούς μου, πέρα τζοπούλα φουντωτή, όντε σε βάλει ο νους μου, όντε σε βάλει ο νους μου, όντε σε βάλει ο νους μου.
με πιάνει πάλι. Άντες, άντες, εδώ με πιάνει πάλι. Θα αγάπησω συλλογισμός και τους εφτά οι ζάλοι. Στο μυρό τσικάλης μιλιάς, καθάρισμα δε θέλει. Χτιάμε το φας και σύφλουδο, χτιάμε το φας και σύφλουδο, γλίξ είναι σαν το μέλι. Ο φας γλίξ είναι σαν το μέλι.
Stelios Petrakis playing lyra, Pericles Papatropoulos playing the lute, Kevan Shemirani on the zarb, and then the voice earlier of Yoyis Kisluris, and that was a traditional Cretan Kontilies and Pentazali. Heady stuff indeed. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3, and now for a bit of respite, here is a delicate piece by the Norwegian hardanger fiddle player Benedicte Morseth. It's called Alda, meaning swell.
Thank you.
The Hardanger fiddle playing of Benedicta Morset and the title track to her album Alder. I'm Verity Sharp. Thanks for listening to Late Junction tonight. I'll be back tomorrow at 11, so do join me then. And I'll just leave you now with the trio of young Americans who are Our Brother the Native and a track of theirs called Younger from their album Make Amends for We Are Merely Vessels. Till tomorrow, good night.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3 Through the Night with me, Jonathan Swain. To come in this opening couple of hours, a Smetana piece for four pianists. First, though, a recent concert from the Croatian Radio and Television Symphony Orchestra and conductor David Jimenez Carreras. It's one from Zagreb in January 2011. Zagreb looking across to Spain, Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Español, and Falla's Three-Cornered Hat Ballet. But they start with something more local, or at least the composer is. He has a Greek name, and Boris Papandopoulou was actually born near Bonn, but he's claimed by Croatia, where he died in 1991 after a long and productive life there. This is his Marche Arabe Symphonique.
Thank you.